Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast, Becca Explains the Occupation. I'm your host, Becca, and I am an Israeli educator on the occupation with a decade of experience examining how the complex realities of the occupation are playing out on the ground in real time. So in this podcast, we'll explore how political decisions and global trends and Israeli politics are shaping the ongoing occupation, especially in this moment. And we'll connect the dots between policies and their real-world impacts, principally on Palestinians, but also on Israelis. For this podcast, I'll be drawing on my background in education and as a political organizer in the West Bank. And I'll be breaking down the systems at play and offer insights into this multifaceted situation. So join me as we delve into the nuances of the occupation, its effects, and the broader context surrounding it. And hey, Mohaned, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Becca.
So Mohaned is joining from Hebron, and what I thought would be kind of interesting for people to hear more about and learn more about is just the reality, kind of the daily reality in the West Bank, especially in the past year, but also just in general. There's been a lot of talk about it the past few days, the past few weeks with Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book. And he also traveled to Hebron during his time in Palestine. So I just think a lot of people, we often take for granted, those of us not under occupation, how deep the occupation and basically living under military control can actually affect people on a daily basis. And Mohaned is a friend of mine. We've known each other for probably about a decade. And so I thought that bringing this conversation to a wider audience was really important. Cool. Maybe I'll just start by saying, for kind of passing it over mainly to Mohaned, that I think Hebron is probably the best example in order to understand what the occupation looks like, because in the West Bank, Hebron is the only city. It's, first of all, the biggest city in the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem. There's about 230,000 people who live there. And then it's the only city under military control in the West Bank, in which it's a majority Palestinian city with an Israeli settlement inside the city. And so there's 230,000 Palestinian residents inside Hebron. But in addition to that, there are 800 Israeli settlers who live inside Hebron. And at any given moment, there's about 650 soldiers who protect them. And the job of the soldiers is pretty much exclusively to protect the Israeli settlers at the price of rights of people, of Palestinians in Hebron. And Mohaned can go into more details in that. But I'll just add that in 1997, there was an agreement between Israel and the Palestinian Authority that basically breaks the city up into half. And I'll include a link between what this map looks like, but basically the city is broken down into two areas, H1 and H2. H1 is the majority of Hebron, it's 80% of the city. And H2 is 20% of the city. And it's where there's a really important religious site called the Cave of the Patriarchs or the Ibrahimi Mosque. It's the same place. And it's where Abraham supposedly buried Sarah, and all of the matriarchs and patriarchs of both Judaism and Islam are buried except for Rachel. And in this area of H2, which is 20% of the city, there's about 30,000 Palestinians who live there. All 800 Israeli settlers also live there. And the only force that functions there is the Israeli military. So Mohaned basically lives his life in H2 under the Israeli military. The Palestinian Authority does not function there. And if Palestinians need defense or services that have to do with, you know, police or social order, anything else, the people that they have to turn to are the Israeli military. But the Israeli military on their part is basically there to ensure the security exclusively of the Israeli settlers. And so, as I think you can probably imagine, that creates a lot of violence and friction. And so, Mohaned, maybe we can start off by just kind of, you know, saying who you are, what do you do in life? And, you know, this past week was the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. And I know that Jewish holidays generally have an effect on the city of Hebron. And so maybe kind of from your perspective, what does it look like? What does it feel like? We'll go from there.
First of all, hello everybody. I don't know the difference in timing between my time because time and yours, but just want to say, you might hear the adhan in the background. It's just going to finish in a minute. You know, as everybody knows, I come from Hebron. I was born and raised in Hebron. I'm 32, so I basically lived all my life in this city. Around, settlements, Israeli settlements. I studied journalism, so I carry a Bachelor of Journalism, and I worked as a journalist. I work also in the sports field. I'm an activist, a political activist, and a human rights defender. If you have ever visited Hebron, then you know Tel Remeda, and I live just near this settlement. And let's start from what Becca ended with, Jewish holidays. It's a nightmare for us here as Palestinians because, H2 forms 20% of Hebron and it is completely under Israeli military control. And I'm talking about H2, the restricted part, because we have two different kinds of H2. We have the H2 restricted under Israeli army control, surrounded by checkpoints. And then you have H2 out of the checkpoints, which is the unrestricted part. But the restricted one, it forms 20% of Hebron. This is what is our main topic going to be. So in Jewish holidays or on Jewish holidays, these checkpoints are being closed by the Israeli army and Palestinian residents. You're talking about 6,000 of Palestinians who live in H2. They are basically locked in their homes. And what happens if there is a Jewish holiday, these soldiers close these checkpoints and people cannot leave their homes. Like Yom Kippur, for example, the night before Yom Kippur, they shut down the checkpoints and it stayed closed the whole day, the next day on Yom Kippur, Sukkot, the first day of Sukkot, the night of Sukkot, and the first day they shut down the checkpoints. And that's not only on Jewish holidays. It also happens regularly now. Even before October the 7th, it happened, but now it happens more in the past year. It's happening more. But what do we face on Jewish holidays as Palestinians? It's not only the closure of checkpoints where, as a Palestinian, you're not allowed to exit or enter these checkpoints, and there are about 23, 24 Israeli checkpoints, main checkpoints, at the entrances and exits of H2. And beside this, you're talking about a lot of different movement restrictions within the H2 part, where we also, there are other parts of H2 where we, as Palestinian residents of that area, these neighborhoods, we're not allowed to reach most of its streets. We are allowed only to walk on certain parts to get out of the checkpoint and go to H1. So on these Jewish holidays, it's not only checkpoints being, let's say, closed, or we are prevented from using them, but also the presence of those settlers who come to visit Hebron on these Jewish holidays, who also attack Palestinian houses, attack Palestinians in the streets. Yesterday, for example, a group of settlers with a dog attacked the Palestinian disabled guy in Tel Remeda, who sits in his little shop. And this guy is disabled. So these settlers attacked him with a dog, and with other settlers, and this is happening regularly now. So, in Jewish holidays, you have checkpoints being blocked. You've got settlers coming to visit the city, who also attack Palestinians. So our movement, in the presence of those settlers in our neighborhoods, we become locked in our homes. For example, Friday, there is a settler who lives next door. He used to attack us a lot. This guy, he was in the army and he was in Lebanon and he was killed in Lebanon. So when he was killed, the night he was killed, when I was walking to get out of the checkpoint, I was chased by a settler car. And to be honest, if I was not alert, if I was not awake, when the car slowed down next to me and turned and followed me, I would have been maybe killed by those settlers because I managed to get out of the checkpoint before they even reached me. And Friday, when they buried him, they shut down the whole area. And to be honest, this is now happening a lot. So Hebron is different from other Palestinian cities because we are the only, or Hebron is the only city in the West Bank that has settlements in the heart of its city. And the settlers we have, they're not just regular or normal ones because they are the ones who actually, I would say, that run the government now, run Israel. We have two ministers in the current Israeli government are from the settlements of Hebron, Kiryat Arba and Avraham Avinu, our father Abraham. And Itamar Ben-Gvir, he lives in Kiryat Arba, he occupied the Palestinian house in Kiryat Arba, and he's the interior minister, the current interior minister in Israel, who runs the police. And we
He's
have Orit Sto.
the minister of the National Minister of Security, I believe is his official title. He's the minister of
Yeah.
responsible for the police, but even kind of his position was created to be to give him more responsibility than previous internal ministers of is security ministers of internal security had before him.
Yes, and then we have Orit Strok, who lives in Shuhada Street. She just lives a few hundred meters away from where I am now. And those two people, they are known as, now current ministers in the current Israeli government, but they were also settlers who used to throw stones at us. They lead settler groups to attack Palestinians, either from Otzma Yehudit or from Kach movement or from other right-wing movements in Israel. So the settlers we have in our city who live here, they're not just regular settlers who attack and throw stones at people's homes. No, they are making rules in Israel, and that is dangerous because those people, they are now running the whole country. They can do whatever they want. They were settlers with a limited power, but now they are settlers in government, settlers with suits making decisions for our lives, and that makes things worse for us. That's one thing. You want to say something, Becca?
Yeah, no, I was thinking a lot about this recently because one of the so for those who don't know, one of the things that's been going on since October 7th is the torture that's happening in this prison, like makeshift prisons called Sde Teiman, or makeshift detainment camp, I think is the more accurate term to use. And one of the guys who was arrested by the army and charged with sexual violence and sexual assault of a Palestinian prisoner is a settler who lives, I believe, in Kiryat Arba, but he is very active in Hebron. Same settler. So for those who don't know, I give tours regularly in Hebron, and I have for about the past six and a half years with a group called Breaking the Silence. And this same settler has I've seen him, and we've seen him both vandalize property, harm Palestinians actively, physically harm, and physically harm activists, Israeli activists, with the group that I'm with, Breaking the Silence. And it's just one of those things, kind of thinking about how you're saying that Ben-Gvir is now, these quite violent people now are in suits and are not only are they making the decisions, but the decisions that they're making are based on this reality in which a whole entire system in Hebron is created so that Israelis are under civil law, Palestinians are under military law. The job of the army is to exclusively carry out the law on Palestinians. The job of the police theoretically is to carry out the law on settlers, but we see that in practicality, settler violence isn't actually dealt with. And so then what really was the expectation when we take someone who has basically a blank check in a lot of ways to be violent against you and against Palestinians in Hebron, and then they become a soldier in Sde Teiman? I think a lot of people looked at that situation as very surprising, but I go back to Hebron and I think the level of violence that happens on a daily basis, especially since October 7th, but of course well before, is both well documented and at this point, I think unsurprising seeing that level of violence not only seep into the system, but become the people in ties pushing the system forward. It was just something that I've been thinking about a lot since the arrest of that same settler from Stetéman, who has a very high track record of violence in Hebron. And I'm sure you know it as well. You've seen it like from him specifically.
And he himself, when there was no accountability at the end for what he did, but he was not accountable by law. But when the military police went to investigate them, because they were not going to arrest them, they went to Stetéman to investigate them, to like talk to them about
Right.
the and he started recording videos and asking all Israelis, not all Israelis, the ones who support him. But he was like really sending a message to all Israelis that they should go to the streets and stop this, because that we are the soldiers who are protecting Israel, we're being investigated. He didn't even want to be investigated about what he did, but that's not the case. He did a huge let's say incitement, so settlers go and invade the military bases, and actually he was not accountable for this incitement, because what we've seen after is that right-wing settlers, including two parliament members from the right wing, invaded Stetéman jail and invaded another military base,
They flee.
to protest against this, and none of them was accountable. So if you look at this, even if there is let's say an evidence of something they have done, the settlers, right wing in Israel, or soldiers, they are not accountable for what they're doing. And that brings me to another topic, which is equality. And when you ever talk to people about that, there is no equality here, they tell you, no, what you're talking about, especially Israelis or soldiers or whoever, or supporters of Israel. No, there is. We have two different sets of law here. I'm not equal with the settler who lives next door, who attacks me every day. I am under the military law. And you know what it means? It means I'm guilty by law till I prove the opposite. It's like, I feel like we are being in the jungle where the lion eats the gazelle because the lion is stronger than the gazelle. That's it. This is the law in Israel. This is the law here. We're not
That's a
equal.
yeah. I mean, that's in the West Bank for sure. And though
Yes.
I think there's no question that it's also seeped into that it's very much seeped into Israel. I want to pause on this question of equality because I think that people often don't realize the level that in the West Bank, and especially if we take Hebron as an example, the group that's supposed to be defending you is the Israeli military, right? And for those, I think I said this in the beginning, but there's 230,000 Palestinians who live in the city of Hebron. Of those, around 30,000 live in this smaller area, about 20% called H2. There's 800 Israeli settlers there as well, in multiple different settlement locations, one of them being Tel Olmeda, where Muhannad lives, which is also the most restricted in terms of movement that you have access to. And then at any given moment, there's 650 soldiers there to protect them, which on the weekends, that number tends to go higher. And I'm sure that this weekend with the holiday, it was more than 650 soldiers. And it was also more than 800 settlers. Maybe not everyone's technically settlers, but you have religious people and often political settlers coming into
And
the
there's the
city
yeshiva
for
students.
these.
The yeshiva students, don't forget, there are 300 in
Of yeshiva
Bet Romano.
students. Yeah, that's part of the count that we have in the 800, but those numbers get much, much bigger definitely during holidays. And I think what a lot of people are missing often when talking about even the Palestinian Authority is that when it comes to the Israeli army, both the Palestinian Authority doesn't function in H2 in terms of the Palestinian police. Right. But also, when the Palestinian Authority does function in other areas of Hebron and H1 and other areas of the West Bank, it's able to perhaps arrest you, Mohammed, for I don't know if you break the traffic law, right? And it can arrest you if there's some issue between you and another Palestinian
True.
citizen. But
Yeah,
if the
it's true.
Israeli army calls and says, we're going to come into Mohammed's house, the Palestinian Authority has absolutely no way to prevent that, regardless of if you've done anything or not, right? Regardless if you or any other Palestinian in Hebron has done anything. And I think that the people are often missing the reality that Palestinians are defensiveless, meaning there is no legitimate means of protection, of a use of a gun, if you will, even in Hebron or anywhere else in the West Bank. And I'm wondering, you know, what that feels like for you, even on the most basic of levels. You know, a lot of times we talk even about what's even needed just to get an ambulance to where you live. You know, like what's the daily actions that kind of you have to take to live your life within this reality of military rule?
Yeah, first, you know, when you talk about that, my government, my police, not only in H2, but also in H1, they can't protect me from Israeli occupation. And as Becca said, when it comes to Israeli army, Palestinian Authority is not functioning, cannot do anything. So that makes us feel as Palestinians that even being in H1, you're not safe at all. You're not safe at all. And it's the feeling that we have, even when we are in our homes, even when we are sleeping, even if I'm going to a cafe, even if I'm going shopping, we don't feel safe. We feel that there is always, that we are always worried that something could happen, even in an area where it's, you know, supposedly be under Palestinian police control. But something very important to tell is, for me, H1, H2, area A, B, C is just on papers. Israeli army can go wherever they want, can do whatever they want, can kill whoever they want. There is no an upper power to control them within this country. They are the upper power. And neither the Palestinian police or anybody can protect you from Israeli violence or from Israeli army violence, because settlers even attack people in H1. Like, they have gone out to H1 and attacked people. So it just, that H2, yeah, it's more attacks. It's less secure. It's less safe. It's not safe at all. But H1 is not better, because whenever the army goes out, it means that you, and there is no specific timing for them going out or doing whatever they're going to do, but you basically don't know, so you can't feel safe. And, you know, returning and talking about H2 and talking about just like daily life, and you know, such as, for example, very easy things, like very simple things, an ambulance. If you are living in, doesn't matter where you come from, like if you live in Germany, you know, if you live in the US, wherever you live, if you call an ambulance, it's gonna come to your house and take you to the hospital, and within certain minutes. You know, it depends on how far is the hospital from you and how bad is your situation too. But we as Palestinians living in H2, an ambulance for us is mission impossible. You know mission impossible? It is mission impossible for us. Why? Because you are living in an area which is fully under Israeli army control. So the first call you usually make to get an ambulance, which you contact the hospital, because you're living in an area like this, other five calls have to come in series. So we call the Palestinian Red Crescent. And because we are in H2, because the ambulance has to cross an Israeli checkpoint and come to an Israeli area under Israeli military control, they have to speak the Palestinian Red Crescent. They have to speak to the Red Cross in Hebron. And then the next goal is going to go for the Arabic speaker of Red Cross. And the Arabic speaker of Red Cross has to speak and call the English speaker of Red Cross. And then the English speaker of Red Cross contacts the civil office of the army, which they call the Israel Civil Administration. Why? The Arabic speaker has to speak to the English speaker of Red Cross, then speak to the Israelis, is basically because the Palestinian employee is not allowed to contact the Israelis directly. So it has to go through the foreign employee at the Red Cross office in the city of Hebron. So here we have four calls. After the Israeli Civil Administration, they have to speak to the commander of the whole army unit in Hebron, military unit in Hebron, that serves in Hebron. And then they speak to the soldier who is standing on one of the checkpoints near Kiryat Arba, which is from here to there, it's 10 minutes by car. And because the ambulance is not allowed to come from other entrances, for example. So six calls. Imagine one of them is in the toilet. You die. And making these six calls takes 1 hour. Takes an hour. So have you ever heard of the golden minutes? In case of emergency, they're like 15 minutes. I don't know. People who studied medicine know. You die. This if you have an in a, if you are in a critical case and you miss these minutes, you're dead. And usually when the call or when the decision comes between the last three calls, the command, the military, the military, you know, the Israeli army, either the civil part of the army or like the commander of the army in the city or the soldier, especially the fourth and fifth ones, the ambulance is not allowed in. Why? For security reasons. I just don't understand what kind of security. Because we all go to the airport, okay? We all enter the airport. You get checked. And after you get checked, you're allowed to go. So if you say security, check the ambulance, which is something I consider stopping an ambulance is a crime. But if you check the ambulance, what would prevent you from letting the ambulance in after that? Because you're saying security. You're using security as a mutual concept to prevent an ambulance from helping people. While settlers here, they have two, three ambulances only in Tel Rumeida. And do you know how far is the hospital? How far is the hospital from where I am now? By walk, if I'm lazy, 7 minutes. If it was open, the ambulance to reach this place where I am now, it takes 2 minutes. It's only 1 kilometer away from me. So it's just basically an ambulance. So you sometimes are worried if you are going to be sick, you might die. You know, for women, for example, if you're a pregnant woman, you know what people in H2 do? Before the birth of the girl, like maybe 1 week, 2 weeks, she moves out to her family's house or relatives. So when it's time to give birth, an ambulance can easily reach her home in H1. So people get out. If somebody, if you're an elder person, an elderly person, if you are an old person, you basically have no or zero assisting tools. You nobody can bring. We are not allowed to drive in H2. So if you're a person on a wheelchair, somebody has to push you all the way to home. And it's not all the roads we use are paved. There are some of the main roads were closed. Some of the main entrances to the neighborhood to the houses are closed. So you have to go between or through the olive yard. Imagine in winter. So this person can't basically live normally. I know people who since almost 1 year or 1 year and a half, they didn't leave their homes. People who are 80, 75, 80, 90 who are in a wheelchair, they didn't leave their home because it's impossible almost to take them out of their homes because there is no road. You're stuck. The car cannot reach your house. You cannot drive. And somebody has to push you in a wheelchair. This is basically what happens. So this is the daily life. Water. It's, for example, water. If we're talking about just the basic need, all Palestinians now suffer from a shortage of water because Israel steals our water, and they sell it back to us, and they give settlers and Israelis 10 times more water than they give to us. It's water. Have nothing to do with security. But in Israel, you know, you don't understand the definition sometimes of security.
I want to pause on that point for a second, Mohamed, because I think people don't always know that. So basically, inside the West Bank, you have a lot of natural resources, water being one of them. And all of the water resources basically are either underground, or if they're above ground, they're in the valleys, which is the same as they are anywhere in the world. That's how water flows. But specifically, if you were to look at a map of the West Bank, you would see that most Palestinian cities that today are under the Palestinian Authority are in Area A. And those cities, that's Area A that's under, full Palestinian Authority control, though the Israeli army can still enter there, but in terms of kind of its civil management, are all on the top of hills. And where the water ends up and where the sources of water are taken are under direct Israeli military control. In the West Bank. And as an occupying power in Israel, we actually don't have the right to really touch Palestinian water sources or any other natural resources. And it's anyway illegal by international law for there to be settlers in the West Bank. But even within there being settlers, another thing that we do that's illegal is the water we're sending the people who live in the West Bank, the settlers who live in the West Bank, which at this point is about 500,000 Israelis, should be coming from within Israel. In practicality, it's coming from within the West Bank. And it's coming at a price that's actually subsidized in most places. So it's actually cheaper than Israelis living inside Israel proper to pay for, and much, much cheaper than Palestinians like Mohammed to pay for, which is then being sold back to the Palestinian Authority. Right? And so it's your water, but
Exactly.
you don't have control over it.
Yeah, it's like I come to your house, I steal your couch and I sell it back to you. But I don't give you the full couch. I just cut it into two half. Or I steal your couches and I just sell you back one for a very expensive price and I just give the rest to my friends for a cheaper price or for free. But what Pekka was talking about, a cheaper life for settlers than Israel. Regular Israelis in Israel, it's related to encouraging settlers and Israelis to move into the settlements in the West Bank. Everything is cheaper. I think it's tax-free in the settlements or cheaper
It's
taxes.
subsidized. There's
Yeah.
taxes, but it's yes, you're right though that it's encouraging people to move there, and it also depends slightly where, but overwhelmingly it's heavily subsidized. And Hebron's not a good example of this. Hebron, the people who live in Hebron live there for ideological reasons, no question. But even in Kiryat Arba, which is nearby, you have people who like settlers basically who were placed there by the government when they moved to Israel in like the 1990s from like the former Soviet Union, for example. And then where they're being placed is considered the periphery, and it's heavily subsidized in order to encourage people moving there. And yeah.
Yeah, so you see that even bus tickets are cheaper, and basically almost everything is cheaper than living in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or other places. But yeah, this is how they run the West Bank. And if you look at the West Bank and you look at we only have very little left as Palestinians, and when we in terms of land and space, maybe 12% less than that, we still have in the West Bank as Palestinians. So something very important that people need to understand is we don't have a state as Palestinians. We don't have a state. We don't have the power. We don't have anything. So Palestine, for people, they say Palestine, but if you're a Palestinian living in this country, we don't have a state. We don't have access to airports. We have to travel out of the country to go to Jordan to fly from there. And this, for example, this thing is it's not just because the Palestinians can't run their own life, because many people think that without Israel, Palestinians can't survive. And I think with Israel, we can't survive as Palestinians because of all the oppression that Israel is practicing on us. We're prevented from building an airport. We're prevented from reaching the sea. We're prevented from visiting our relatives. We're prevented sometimes from even leaving our cities. So Israel is preventing us from living as Palestinians. This is what is basically happening since 75 years, 76 years of occupation. Palestinians, and if you look at the country, if you look at the West Bank, if you look at Gaza, and if you look at Palestinians who live in Israel, Israel use different kind of tactics with every one to kick us out of the country. Like in 48, they use a complete different tactic from the one they use in Gaza, from the one they use in the West Bank, and even between cities. So, well, if you want to see the future plan of the current Israeli government, is that you basically need to listen to their statements when they talk, whether it's Netanyahu, whether it's Ben-Gvir, whether it's Smotrich, whether it's the Israeli ambassador at the UN, whether it's the Israeli ambassador in the US, other Israeli ambassadors in Europe, such as the one who is currently in London, Tzipi. Yeah,
Very.
yeah, she's very cute. She wants all of us out. But yeah, you need to listen to those people. They're not talking about peace. They're talking about cutting the country into pieces and kicking all Palestinians out. And there was this interview of Itamar Ben-Gvir with an Israeli channel called Channel 11 or Canon News of Ben-Gvir's plan for future here. And the interviewee, he was telling him, what do you want to do with the Palestinians? Are they going to be allowed to have a state? Because the one who was interviewing him is a Palestinian from East Jerusalem who works for this channel. So he said to him, are you going to let Palestinians create their own state? He said, no, there will be no Palestinian state. And he said to him, okay, will they be able to claim an Israeli passport or an Israeli identity? And he said, no, they're not going to be given an Israeli passport. And he said to him, okay, what are you going to do with them? Are you going to let them vote? He said, no, they're not going to be able to vote there. So he said they will be welcome to live here basically as 50-class citizenship, like dogs and cats in Israel will have. And actually, at the moment, they have more rights than us as Palestinians. But this is Ben-Gvir's plan. And it's not a minority now in Israel. And unfortunately, it's a majority. It's not a minority, it's a majority. This is a lot of Israelis now are thinking this way because they keep saying that there is no partner for peace on the Palestinian side. But to be honest, it's the opposite. The Palestinians don't see that there is a partner for peace and in peace with the Israelis now, and unfortunately. And who is making this impossible, peace impossible at the moment is people like these in the government who are doing everything they can to just kick the Palestinians out. And look at now northern Gaza, what they're doing in Jabalia. Yesterday, a massacre. Now we are talking about thousands of massacres in Gaza since October the 7th and killing thousands and thousands of Palestinians, more than 43,000. Look at them, what they're doing. They're trying to kick the people out of North Gaza to the south, and maybe the future plan is to kick all of them to Egypt. So this is what's happening. So now every day and every day and every day, there are massacres. And every day, maybe you'll find 5 to 10 massacres. And there are different kinds of attacks in the West Bank. And it's all funded and supported by the current Israeli government. It's funded, supported by the current Israeli government and also other Israeli governments. But this one, this current government, is fully a settler government.
I think people often want to push back on this idea, and I get it a lot, both from the main work that I do with Israelis and also from abroad, especially from, I think, Jewish communities abroad, but not exclusively, is this idea that we really want a two-state solution, but there aren't partners. But the reality is that there's actually not a single Jewish Israeli political platform right now that's actually currently offering a two-state solution. The closest to it would be they're called the Democrats, led by this guy named Yair Golan, who's not currently a member of Knesset, but he is the head of the party. He was recently voted to be the head of the party, who both is talking about occupying southern Lebanon, and who simultaneously is talking about getting rid of settlements, but not getting rid of the occupation, right? Meaning we'll take away the settlers in Hebron who are violent, but we won't take away the violence of kind of entering people's homes at night. And I just think it's an interesting reflection that we so often believe what we want to believe about political leadership. But as you're saying, I think it's really true that the current political government, they're not hiding themselves. They're not refraining from talking about what their plan is. And even just a few days ago, I believe it started today, there was there's a multiple day resettlement of Gaza, like event happening. And as a part of that, or at the same time, I'm not sure if it's an official part of it, but there is one specific for the Likud, which is a right-wing party, but it's Netanyahu's party. It's the party that up until I would say 10, 15 years ago was really seen as a pragmatic right-wing party. Even when Netanyahu encouraged Ben-Gvir to join the government in 2018, it was so he could keep his seat. He says, we don't have the same political beliefs as Ben-Gvir. But today, of the slightly more than 30 Likud members who have seats in the Knesset, there's 120 seats in the Knesset, 11 of them are participating in this resettlement of Gaza. And again, I think it goes back to what you were talking about of the people who have been so violent historically in Hebron are some of the same people today who have the ties, who are making the decisions. And it's affecting much more than just those parties. Obviously, I'm an Israeli who's against occupation and our voice exists, but we really don't have a political platform today. And I wanted to ask you, and then we'll after this we'll pause and we'll go to questions, but what is your vision? I've known you for a decade. You are a nonviolent activist. I think probably you've dealt throughout your life living in Hebron in the Second Intifada. I mean, you grew up as a child in the Second Intifada and in one of the most violent places between the river to the sea the past year. And every day you wake up and you choose to be a member of Youth Against Settlements, and every day you choose to engage in nonviolence. And to do it actively, right? I think a lot of people think the nonviolence means passivity, and that's not what you're doing. But maybe you disagree with that at this point. But why nonviolence, and why, to be so willing? I think when the political situation is so hard, and it's hard to find partners on the other side, so why continue to kind of agree to reach out and do so?
You know, Becca, I'm gonna respond to your question with a question.
Go for it.
What is possible to do now? There is nothing. You know, we as people living in this country, everything has been tried. And unfortunately, nothing is working. So now, me as a Palestinian, I'm sitting here. I believe if you speak to any Palestinian, we say that it's very easy in this country to lose hope. It's very easy. But if we lose hope as Palestinians, if I lose hope as Muhammad, what are the chances that I just can survive? It's impossible because the last thing is left to us as Palestinians is hope. We want to keep it as much as possible. We want to work to grow up this hope inside of us as Palestinians. This is one of the reasons I continue in what I'm doing today. And it's not only that, it's also to give hope to my people. And because I believe that people make the change, people make the difference. Yes, at the moment, politicians are too strong, but people in the West, they can choose. They can choose who can represent them. And in this, we want to keep convincing people. We want to keep working to keep convincing people not to vote for the wrong people. Maybe there is no right people there for elections, but unfortunately, we come to a point we have to choose between the worst and the bad. So if we have to choose, we're not going to choose the worst until another leadership comes that cares about people's voices and cares about the human beings. But for us as Palestinians, we have nothing left except hope. And we wanna keep this hope because we wanna live just like any other person in the world. But I am saying to you, Becca, if you live in this country, it's super easy to lose hope because too much is happening that is beyond the capacity of human beings to perceive. But again, it's only hope that is left to us. And the Israeli occupation is trying to kill this hope. And we are fighting to not let this hope die and even to grow up this hope inside of us and keep fighting for it. And the other thing is, if we are gonna if violence, like look at the killing in Gaza, is it solving anything? It's not. So if is violence, we have to ask ourselves a question, is violence going to solve anything? I don't believe so. I don't believe so. So whenever we talk about this country, we say that violence is not the solution. It's not even two equal sides when it comes to military equipment. So, and even if it's two, you know, well-equipped sides, violence is not the solution. If you want to look, if you want to see, if you want to know why, look at Russia and Ukraine. Now 3 years of war and nobody is winning anything. Everybody is losing. So for me, in violence, everybody loses. There is no winner in wars. That's why nonviolence, it's not only a way to fight the occupation. It's also a, would say it's a way to live. It's a way to live in your personal life. If you use violence, it affects you so much. And if you use nonviolence, it affects you so much. So we come to a conclusion that, okay, I want to take that path. Did we achieve something? Yes. Becca and I know we have done a lot of work. We have changed a lot of people's minds. We have achieved a lot. Like the house, our association, it was occupied by the Israeli settler army. Then the settlers started moving in. We managed to get the house back from them. And it's a Palestinian home. So we have achieved something. We are, you know, your presence using nonviolence helps the community around you. And we have many Palestinians. And we have a lot of achievements in this. And if you want to know, for example, in Jerusalem, a few years ago, there was the Israeli army wanted to put on metal detectors at the entrances and exits of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People fought nonviolently, protested. They didn't do anything. They just sat in front, you know, near the gates of Al-Aqsa and refused to leave. They didn't do anything, not stone throwing, nothing. They just sat. It took them only a few weeks, and the army gave up. They couldn't continue. And then they decided, okay, there will be no metal detectors at the entrances and exits of Al-Aqsa Mosque. So people, we have achieved a lot. We are achieving a lot, but we just need, because people need to understand, we need the support of people. That's why we speak, me, Becca, that's why we find this space. We sit here and we speak to you, because we need your support. We need your activism. We need you to be active where you come from, and especially if you're a Western person, if you come from the United States, Europe, we know that there's a huge support from your governments that comes to Israel, to the Israeli occupation. It needs to stop. This massive support to the occupation needs to stop. And there should be a movement from your governments, and that's going to come from when you put pressure on them to ask Israel to end the occupation and give us as Palestinians a state. Give us our full rights, where we feel that we are equal with the Israelis, we are equal with everybody else around the world. So that's why we talk to you. We want you to be active, to make at least a little change, because what we are living here as Palestinians is only making us lose hope. We are fighting back to win a little hope. So when we see you fighting, when we see people coming to listen, when we see people fighting, doing everything they can, it gives us hope. It gives me hope. It gives Becca hope to believe more in what she believes in, to do, to keep going. And me too. So you make a lot of difference in our lives. And we would ask you, you know, not to stop or try. If you're not active, to start being active and do something. So something changes here.
Thank you, Mohamed.
Thank you, Becca.
Thank you so much for joining and listening, and I hope that you found it fruitful and interesting, and that it gave you a little bit more insight into the reality of the occupation in Hebron and in general. This was a part one, the conversation between me and Mohamed, and I'm going to also add the part two, which was questions and answers from the audience. So make sure to look out for that. If you found this podcast interesting and helpful, I would really appreciate your support. You can do so at buymeacoffee.com/BeccaExplains or through Venmo at Becca Explains. And I'm also adding a link in order to support Youth Against Settlements, the group where Mohamed is an organizer and activist. Thanks so much for joining.